Lecture 6, Confucius, in Praise of Sage Kings.
Hello again. Are you ready for a little change of pace? We've been following events at the Darshana Hotel for some time, remember, in India, up until about the first century AD. We're now going to shift our focus to China, to the Dao Hotel. And then that means we're going to jump back in time to the beginning of the conference going on there. The first Chinese philosopher was Confucius, who, like the Bhagavad Gita, was concerned with community, with social obligations, but he comes at these issues from a very different historical background. Now, Confucius may be somebody that you've heard of before, but perhaps don't know a lot about. He lived in about 500 BC, so he was a contemporary of the Buddha, maybe 100 years before Plato in ancient Greece. Confucius is probably the most significant thinker in Chinese history, which would have come as a surprise to Confucius himself. When he died at the age of 73, he thought about himself as a failure. I mean, his main ambition in life was to serve in government, to put his ideas into action. He never really held a significant position, and as a fallback, he became a teacher. It's sort of sad that he's a failure in life, and then he becomes a teacher. But apparently, he was a pretty good teacher, because some of his students got jobs, which may have been a little bit bittersweet for him. I mean, he's happy for his students, but at the same time reminded of his own failures at what he really wanted to do. Confucius, like Socrates, like Jesus, never wrote anything himself. But after his death, his disciples put together a collection of his teachings called the Analects, which is the most influential book written in the Chinese language. It was studied and memorized for 2,500 years by students in China and in Japan and Korea. It's undoubtedly one of the most influential books, not just in Chinese history, but in world history. And it's very quotable. You'll be hearing me give a lot of quotes in this lecture from the Confucian Analects. Within a few centuries of Confucius's death, most people in China had adopted his analysis of what was wrong with the world and how best to remedy it. So Confucianism is not just a philosophy. It's more like a religion in that it provides a comprehensive worldview. It provides meaning in life. It gives guidelines, specific guidelines for living. Today in East Asia, people live by Confucian principles, even if they're not exactly sure where they had come from. Chinese history is divided into dynasties, and Confucius lived toward the end of one of the longest of those. It's called the Zhou Dynasty, and it was founded some 500 years before he was born, about 1045 BC. It had followed the Shang Dynasty, and that became older and corrupt and lost the mandate of heaven. And so there were some kings, Kings Wan and Wu, who took over and started the Zhou Dynasty. These are sage kings. The kingdom of China was much too large for any single person to rule over. So they ended up with a system sort of like feudalism in the medieval West. So they divided the territory into lots of units and then put some rulers in each local area, sort of like junior kings. And they had lots of relatives. Those are the people that you're going to trust to make your associated kings. And those relatives had lots of sons, each of whom deserved some part of the kingdom. Eventually, there were about 200 kingdoms or little states all over China, semi-autonomous, but related by blood, sometimes distantly, to the Zhou kings. Over time, those ties of kinship started to weaken, and these states started to compete with each other for resources and for territory. And by competition, I mean warfare. I mean, they're starting to fight with each other, to take each other over, to annex each other. So there's the period called the Spring and Autumn Era, and it goes from about 722 to 479 BC. And Confucius lives at the very end of this period. In that 240 years, the number of states goes from about 100, they'd already been reduced from their height, 100 to 40. I mean, you can see how this process is going. And in the same 240 years, there were maybe 500 battles between states, 100 civil wars. So this is a time of violence, and increasing civil disorder. There are assassinations and murders, and ministers who stage coups and take over. There are intrigues, often deadly intrigues, among aristocratic families. Battle was no longer an elegant competition among aristocrats fighting in chariots, sort of like in the Iliad, or actually like in the Mahabharata, in the Bhagavad Gita as well. But instead, there were large-scale slaughter that came as huge infantries of commoners were put in the field to fight with each other. The old ceremonies were treaties that were sealed by killing a sacrificial animal and then smearing its blood on one's lips while swearing an oath to the gods to uphold the provisions of that treaty. But the gods were the ancestors of the weakened house of Zhou. Remember, ancestor worship is the fundamental religion in China. And people began to speak of koxie wei gan, which means to break an oath while blood is still wet on one's lips. You just couldn't trust anyone. Things are falling apart, moral confusion, universal distrust, and warfare, and of course, tremendous suffering. This is the world that Confucius is born into. Okay. We don't know a lot about his life. The first biography of him was written 400 years after his death. But from the Analects, we can piece together some information. He was born in 551 BC to the lowest level of the aristocracy in the state of Lu. It's a small state, but it has a cultural heritage that goes back to the earlier Shang dynasty. It's now in the Shandong Peninsula in the northeast of China. His name was Kong Cho. The Jesuits, missionaries coming in the 16th century, coined the term Confucius, which is a Latinized form of Kong Fuzi, which means revered master Kong, which is a name they picked up somewhere. Chinese actually don't use that term very much. They just call him Kongzi, master Kong. And then we'll call him Confucius. His father died when he was 3. He was raised by his mother. They were a poor family, but he did manage to receive an education, but not a job. He once said, "If there are any of the princes who would employ me, in the course of 12 months, I should have done something considerable. In 3 years, the government would be perfected." But that's wishful thinking, because he didn't really get a job. It's the kind of thing you might say in an interview. At about 30, he became a teacher of traditional culture, of ritual and ethics and statecraft. At the age of 51, he was employed as a magistrate for a small time period, and then a minister of public works, minister of justice. It looked like a career was starting, but then he had a falling out with the ruler. He left his native state of Lu at the age of 55. He wandered around from state to state with his students, looking for jobs, looking for someone to employ him. He was turned down by everyone, dozens of rulers in multiple states. He finally returned back home at the age of 68, and then he died a few years later in 479 BC. So he lived into his early 70s, but by that time, his adult son had died, as had his favorite disciple on that occasion. He said, "Alas, heaven has destroyed me." Confucius probably thought that that was about the end of it. But we have a book called The Analects. That's the Greek word for selections. The Chinese term lunyu is more like conversations. So after his death, you can imagine his students sitting around saying, "Do you remember once Confucius said this or that?" And then they said, "We're getting older. We should write that down before it's all lost with us." So they put together this book. It consists of 500 brief quotations or anecdotes that are arranged into 20 books. They call them books, but they're chapter-length books. The whole thing isn't that long. Scholars today still argue about how this book, The Analects, came together. It was probably put together over several centuries. There were editions and revisions. But for our purposes now, we'll take the collection as a whole, as it was known in Imperial China. You can read it in an afternoon. It's not that long. When you open it up, you'll find this odd fortune cookie kind of format. Let me give you some examples. The very famous first lines of it say, "The master said," they'll talk about the master, it's always Confucius, "the master said, 'Is it not a pleasure, having learned something, to try it out at due intervals? Is it not a joy to have friends come from afar? Is it not gentlemanly not to take offense when others fail to appreciate your abilities?'" He had some personal experience with the last one, right? He felt fairly unappreciated. These are rhetorical questions, right? The answer is going to be yes to these. But they do focus one's attention. Even now, When I have friends that show up at my house, they pull into the driveway after a long trip, I think, is it not a joy to have friends come from afar? Of course it is. Another quotation. These are almost at random. The master said, learning without thought is pointless. Thought without learning is dangerous. Let's do another one. The master said, Zilu, he's speaking to one of his students, shall I teach you what knowledge is? When you know a thing, to hold that you know it. And when you do not know a thing, to allow that you do not know it. This is knowledge. Actually, Plato says something sort of like that. To know what you don't know is the beginning of knowledge. These are very practical, concrete sorts of suggestions rather than a theoretical, systematic philosophy. Basically, Confucius is answering questions. And sometimes, in the Analects, we get the question, sometimes we just get the answer without the question. There are also some stories about Confucius that are thrown in there, some sayings of his disciples, and the topics are all mixed up. They're not thematic at all. And Confucius was a teacher. So sometimes the same question is asked by different students, and you'll get different answers. Now, I'm not sure this is because Confucius is being inconsistent or had forgot what he said before. I think he's addressing the particular needs of particular students. So some of them he urges forward, and others he tries to hold back a little bit. But you can imagine how frustrating this might have been for students. Hear all of these different answers to questions. One of his students, Zigong, once asked, is there one single word that can serve as a principle of conduct for life? Right? Just give me one thing that I can focus on. And Confucius replied, perhaps the word reciprocity will do it. Do not do unto others what you do not want others to do unto you. I'm not saying that Jesus stole that, but Confucius was there first by about 500 years. All right, so you've got all of these nice sayings, slogans, aphorisms. Do they add up to a coherent social vision? And I believe that they do. The problem Confucius was facing was the breakup of society, violence, lawlessness, and his answer was to return to the morality of the past, that of the sage kings of the early Zhou dynasty. So social standards come from sages, from wise men, rather than from revelation or from innovative thinking. Confucius himself said, I'm a transmitter, I'm not an innovator. Confucius didn't exactly found a school of philosophy, even though we call it Confucianism. That's not what they call it in China. He belonged to a scholarly movement that's called Ru, so we might call it Ruism, which preserved ancient texts and ceremonies. Even today, the Chinese term for Confucianism is Ruja, the school of the Ru, and Ru means something like ritual specialists or classicists. But Confucius was the most prominent figure within that tradition, and this matters because they were masters of traditional music and dance. So Confucius talks about harmony and learning by doing and by example, and those examples he's going to find in family and in the government. So I'm going to be more systematic than Confucius is in the Analects, and I will give you five major themes that can be found there. So the first one is education. If you want to return to the morality of the past, you need to know about the past. So you need to know something of history. You need to know something of literature, sort of traditional works that have been passed on, especially the five Confucian classics. The Ru school sort of adopted these ancient Chinese texts and made them their own. They include the venerated documents, the classic of poetry, the spring and autumn annals, that was a history of Confucius' native state of Lu, the record of ritual, and the classic of change, which some of you may know as the I Ching. It's a divination manual. Confucius is doing a little bit like what the Upanishads did in developing ideas in the Vedas. He's sort of taking these traditional texts and developing ideas within them. So education was the first principle. The second is moral government. Here's a quote. Ji Kang, who was a ruler, was distressed about the number of thieves in his state, and he inquired of Confucius how to do away with them. Confucius said, if you yourself, sir, were not covetous, although you should reward them to do it, they would not steal. Right? He basically says, if you want your people to quit stealing from each other, you should quit stealing from them. And you can imagine the response was, you know, next, show me some other candidate for this job. Confucius once compared the rulers to the wind and the people to the grass. So whichever way the wind blows, the grass will bend. People will follow the example of their rulers. The third principle is ritual and music. Okay, the Chinese term is li, and it means ceremony, manners, etiquette, customs. The idea here is there are certain specified behaviors that will help you become a better person, that will channel emotions. So, for example, think about the death of a parent, which can be a very traumatic, heart-wrenching experience. People hardly know what to do with themselves. But we have a series of rituals where there's a viewing, there's a funeral, you put the casket into the hearse, everybody drives to the cemetery with their lights on. When you're doing those kinds of things, it gives you a way to channel, to focus those otherwise chaotic and overwhelming feelings. On the other hand, if when your parents die, your first response is, yes, now I get the house, which is completely inappropriate, going through those rituals might help you develop the right sorts of attitudes. But it's not just rule books. It's an adaptation. The scholar, the gentleman, will know how to harmonize these requirements. Lin Fang, one of his students, asked, what is the root of ritual? And the master said, big question. In ceremonies, prefer simplicity to lavishness. In funerals, prefer grief to formality. So a Confucian scholar is going to have some flexibility. The fourth theme is individual effort. He talks about run, which means benevolence, humaneness, goodness. It's sort of the culminating virtue. The Chinese character is the number two, or the character for two, alongside a piece that means people. It has to do with how people interact with each other. And he talks about a gentleman versus an inferior man. Here's some quotes. What the gentleman seeks is in himself. What the inferior man seeks is in others. Another. The gentleman agrees with others without being an echo. The small man echoes without being in agreement. Okay. So is Confucius conservative? I mean, he's looking back to this old ways of doing things. And there's an element of that. But there's also something new here. Because he's saying that a gentleman is not just someone who's born into a noble family. That was the traditional definition. But he says anyone can be a gentleman if they act according to these principles. Right? It's merit, not birth, that matters. And that's kind of a radical idea in early China. His fifth and last theme is hierarchy. A quotation, Duke Jing of Qi, the state of Qi, asked Confucius about government. Confucius replied, there's government when the prince is a prince and the minister is a minister, when the father is father and the son is son. Okay, what? What he has in mind is if every father acted as a father should, was concerned with the welfare of his children, made sure they were educated, protected them, took care of them, and if every child, every son, acted as a son should, showing respect for his father and obedience and deference, then every family would run much more smoothly. Right, and so also for those other relationships. The Confucians talk about five relationships: ruler to subject, parent to child, husband to wife, older brother to younger brother, and friend to friend. Okay. Each of those relationships is unequal, with the possible exception of the last. There's a superior and a subordinate. I myself am the oldest of six children, of five brothers. It seems like a great idea to me to have my younger brothers be deferent and obedient to me. I'm not sure they see it the same way. For a modern example, perhaps, let me ask the question, would the divorce rate be lower if all wives were obedient to their husbands? And at this point, it sounds sort of controversial, but stay with me here. I think the answer is yes, but certainly at a cost. I mean, there would be a number of women who were trapped in unhappy relationships, but they would be staying together for the sake of their families, which would remain intact. Now, sometimes I have students who hear this and they say, Professor Hardy, if you're just looking for hierarchy, couldn't you get the same result if all husbands were obedient to their wives? Sure. But Confucius would never have thought that way, right? He does belong to ancient China. And he doesn't say very much about women. That's a lack that's going to be remedied by a woman scholar, a female scholar named Ban Zhao. We'll hear more about her in Lecture 15. Okay, in some ways, my example is a fair comparison, because Confucianism does stress the importance of sacrificing oneself for the good of the group, right? For the good of the family. In other ways, it's unfair, because Confucius would put a lot of emphasis on the duties that husbands had to their wives, and also Women as mothers have a tremendous amount of authority over their children, even over their adult sons. So in the end, age is a more important differential than gender. One of the most important moral obligations in Confucianism is filial piety. So this is respect for parents, but it's sort of an awkward term because we don't really have anything in English that captures the full extent of what this Chinese virtue is. This isn't just little children sort of obeying their parents. This is an adult virtue. So you're not just showing respect and obedience to your parents and taking care of them in their old age. Truly filial children, now we're talking about adults, will do everything to make their parents happy and will continue to follow the ways of their parents for at least 3 years after their parents have died. Indeed, they should be in mourning for throughout those 3 years. Okay. And Confucius, of course, is going to give you very practical advice on how this should happen. I'm going to quote, "When his parents are alive, a son should not go far abroad. If he does, he should let them know where he goes." Another piece of advice, "Behave in such a way that your father and mother have no anxiety about you, except concerning your health." He also says children should know how old their parents are at any time. Just for the record, as of today, my father is 73, my mother is 71. Okay. In Confucianism, hierarchy does not equal oppression. That's oftentimes the way we think about it. There's going to be this sort of natural clash between those above and those below. Instead, there are these they're hierarchical, but they're non-confrontational relationships. Think about, say, mentoring, where clearly there's a superior and there's a subordinate, but that relationship works harmoniously for the good of both parties. Where I think about my parents' marriage. My parents have a more traditional marriage than I have. When I was growing up, my father was the head of the house. What he said is what happened. But when I got a little older and started to look at how my parents actually interacted, I realized that my father never said, "This is what we're going to do," until he knew what my mother wanted to have happen. So who's in control of this relationship? It's hard to say, but it's not really about being in control. According to Confucius, we're not autonomous individuals. Our identities are defined by the web of relationships in which we live. So we're parents, we're children as well, we have siblings, we have a boss, perhaps you are a boss. The result of all of these five themes, remember, education, moral government, ritual, individual effort, and hierarchy, is a society that's spontaneously cooperative, rather than being competitive or antagonistic. The model for government is the family, rather than a legal contract about, you know, rights and responsibilities. The family is where we learn morality, which then can carry over into the wider world. Today in China, in my opinion, there hasn't been a strong tradition of rule of law. Things often get done by relationships, something called guanxi. There's also not a lot of room for rights or for privacy. I mean, think about the one-child policy a few years ago. I mean, even the most intimate decisions that a couple makes, the government is there. It's a very paternalistic government. But remember that in the Confucian ideal, paternalism is not necessarily bad. I mean, there are such a thing as a good father who cares about the well-being of his children. It depends on the morality of the rulers, whether this system works or not. Let me offer some general observations. Confucius doesn't put so much focus on rules and punishments as much as on instilling the proper attitudes and habits. So a very famous quote says, "The master said, if you try to guide the common people with coercive regulations and keep them in line with punishments, the common people will become evasive and will have no sense of shame. If, however, you guide them with virtue and keep them in line by means of ritual, the people will have a sense of shame and will rectify themselves." Okay, so to apply that to, say, filial piety, if you want your people to show respect for their parents, you could require, you know, payments to say, you know, after your parents turn 65, you need to give them this much money every month. But then people will start to hedge on that. They'll say, yeah, but I gave my dad a gift and it was worth this much, or I took my mother to the grocery store 3 times and I'll figure out the gas. And if you give very specific rules, people will start to argue with the rules. Confucius says it's much better to give people the right sort of attitude. I live in the South now, and Confucius would love the custom of teaching your children to say yes, sir, and no, ma'am. And that respect that they would have for parents would extend to older people in general as well. Confucius wasn't entirely opposed to law and punishments. I mean, he, after all, was involved with government. But good rulers won't have to employ them very often. They'll more be able to guide their people through example. All right. When someone tells you, you should be moral in this way or that way, it's fair to ask, why? Why should I do that? And it's interesting what Confucius does not say. He doesn't say, you should live like this because if you don't, God will punish you or you'll go to hell. In fact, here's another quotation. It's more like this. Ji Lu, one of his disciples, asked about the worship of gods and spirits. Confucius said, we don't know yet how to serve men. How can we know about serving the spirits? What about death was the next question. And Confucius said, we don't know yet about life. How can we know about death? Confucius is not irreligious, right? Ancestor worship is there. It's the basic religion of China. Ancestor worship rituals are part of Li, of ceremony. Confucius talks about the mandate of heaven, which isn't a personal god. It's more of an impersonal moral force, sort of the sky that watches over. It doesn't reward or punish immediately. So it's not exactly religion that's going to keep you in doing these Confucian things. It's not prosperity either. Confucius says that sometimes choosing the right will leave you poor and unemployed, but that's still what you ought to do. Right? That was his experience. He says, you should live in this way because it's the right thing to do, because it's good for humankind generally, because it's worked in the past, back in the days of the ancient sage kings, because it fits human nature. Okay, some later history for Confucianism. It was eventually adopted as the official ideology in the Han Dynasty. It's about 200 BC to 200 AD. It was associated with Imperial China through the civil service exams that lasted until 1905. They were tested on their knowledge of the Confucian classics. So for thousands of years, well, for a couple of thousand years, boys learned to read by memorizing the Analects. They didn't have any idea about what the principles were, but, you know, these words were in their head. There's a certain flexibility that comes with Confucianism because these sort of fragmented short quotes are open to new interpretations, the most important of which was Neo-Confucianism in the 12th century. Okay, we ought to address two more questions before we quit. The first one is Confucianism practical? I mean, will this really work for a society or for a family, even for an individual? A philosophy that emphasizes deference to those in authority and knowing one's place in society so that everything can run harmoniously, that can be turned to oppressive ends. In late imperial China, Confucianism was associated with foot binding, with concubinage, with the inability of widows to remarry. Many people in the 19th century blamed Confucius for China's poverty and backwardness. This, I think, is a distortion. Originally, Confucianism was intended to allow all members of society to flourish, to reach their potential. Remember that status isn't necessarily fixed at birth. Indeed, sometimes, Confucius said, being filial meant speaking up, respectfully, of course, but telling your parents when you thought they were making a mistake. Now, if they didn't listen to you, you still had to go along with it, but sometimes there's that. Would it work for a nation? Confucius wanted to make a difference, as did his followers. They wanted to change things for the better, to be progressive while still holding on to what was most valuable from the past. But in sometimes in places, that may be impossible, especially when the government is corrupt or tyrannical. And in those cases, good Confucians don't seek office, but they retire from public life and focus on their immediate surroundings, like family. Okay. Can Confucianism work in a family? For some years, we had some discussions about putting a poster in my teenage daughter's room with a quotation from the Analects that would have reminded her of several ideals of the Confucian gentleman, who, as it says, takes care when observing to see clearly, when listening to hear distinctly, when in doubt to ask questions, when angry to ponder the consequences, when gaining an advantage to consider whether it's fair. I'll leave it to your imagination as to what kinds of problems may that seem like a good idea. In one's personal life, there's an openness to learning in all situations, from both the good or the bad. Confucius said, when I'm walking along with two others, they may serve me as my teachers. I'll select their good qualities and follow them, and their bad qualities and avoid them. Okay, I want to leave you with more than a sense of Confucius as just like sayings. Confucius was a truly inspiring person. Not just random pieces of advice, but he offered a program for lifelong moral development. And you might think about where you are in this. The master said, at 15, I had my mind set on learning. At 30, I stood firm. At 40, I had no doubts. At 50, I knew the decrees of heaven. At 60, my ear was attuned. At 70, I could follow what my heart desired without transgressing what was right. What a lovely idea. I could follow my heart's desire without transgressing what was right. Imagine that you're facing a difficult decision, a moral dilemma. And if you're like me, you might be tempted to take the easy way out. You might be tempted to choose the path that's going to benefit you personally. But because of your moral upbringing, your integrity, you know, thanks to the parents, thanks because you're basically a decent person, you make yourself do what you know you should. What would it be like if your first natural impulse was to do the right thing? Another quotation. The Duke of Shu asked Zilu about Confucius. And this is what Zilu didn't have an answer. He went back and said, what should I have said? Confucius said, why didn't you tell him that I'm a person who forgets to eat when he's enthusiastic about something, forgets all his worries in his enjoyment of it, and is not aware that old age is coming on? Again, a lovely ideal. To be so engaged in what you love that your worries disappear, that you hardly notice that you're getting older. Confucius was not a dour moralist. He loved goodness. He enjoyed life. He exhibited an infectious enthusiasm for learning and teaching. His is a practical philosophy that can only be truly understood by putting at least some of his principles into action. Remember that famous opening line of the Analects. Is it not a pleasure, having learned something, to try it out at due intervals? And now's your chance. Thanks.